Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is a host we had on a while back, but it's been a while, Beth Oren.
Hello. Hi, John.
Hi. You want to tell everyone what you've been up to in the time since we last talked?
Yeah, my goodness, it's been a while. I've published some books. I write romance, historical romance mostly, some contemporary, but I've published 3 books now under my pseudonym, Beau North, spelled just like it sounds, and that has kept me very busy for the past few years.
And you are also a podcaster, much more seasoned than I am, actually.
I don't know about that, but one of your other former guests, Sammy Campbell, and I have a podcast where we watch modern adaptations of Jane Austen films and discuss it, and it's very silly, very zany. We just, like, our next 2 episodes, we're starting to run out of things to watch, so the last one we did, it'll come out this Monday, is it was a card game. We're playing a card game called Marrying Mr. Darcy. So that's very silly. And then we had, last night we watched a Jane Austen themed improv show called Austentatious that we'll be talking about.
Well, we're not doing Jane Austen this time. We are
no.
doing...
No, because I would be laughing a lot more if we were.
No, this time we are doing Kate Chopin's 1899, The Awakening. Now, this was a book that I know I read, and mm-hmm. I was trying to remember when I read it. I believe I didn't read this in high school. I believe I read this at the end of a graduate course on 19th century American literature. And one of the reasons I believe that is it came at the very end of the course on 19th century American literature. And that course, we read all of Moby Dick over the semester. Oof. We cut it up into like 4 or 5 segments, and then we would read something else in between those segments. And I was very tired at the end of that. This was graduate school. I was working. I thought I was interested in the material, but I was really ready for the 19th century to be done. And I have to admit, I had very little memory in my head of the plot of The Awakening. Somehow in my head I had it conflated with The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and they aren't at all the same book, and one's much shorter than the other, but they both are these proto-feminist American novelettes about the place of women in domesticity. I can see why my brain did that. and you were the one who brought this up to me. What's your background with this book?
Well, it was a book that my cousin was. I was staying with my cousin the summer I was 15, and she was in college at the time and had just taken, you know, an English lit course, and she had this book laying around, and I just picked it up and read it and loved it. And of course, being 15, didn't know what in the hell. I understood the book and I understood it, but I saw like the character as this great heroine at the time, and it didn't really sink into me like how freaking sad the story is until rereading it as an adult, you know, rereading it 20 years later. It's really tough. It's a challenging read.
It's also a book that falls into the category of Southern literature. It's a book that is written by a Southerner. I believe Chopin is from Missouri. Mm-hmm. The action all takes place in New Orleans. We have this pattern emerging in all of the books we read in Sophomore Lit, which are the books by Southern authors that deal with Southern identity tend to be a little bit problematic or complicated in their.
I would say challenging.
Challenging, yes. Towards the idea, the ideals of the South, and certainly this book isn't necessarily only about that. I think it's more primarily about
indicative of the time,
right? Yeah. But it's I worry about this because you know we live in this time where the country is so divided and still divided along, it seems, the Mason-Dixon line as far as our culture goes, and it bothers me that up in the North it seems like the only Southern authors we like to read are people like, you know, Faulkner or we read Kill a Mockingbird, which is an extremely critical book about the South. I don't know. Are there any great Southern authors?
Carson McCullers, maybe?
I just don't know if any that aren't tortured.
Right. You know, let me think about it. I mean, yeah, there are some that are a little more on the silly side. And you start getting into genre fiction, but it's definitely nothing you would read in your 10th grade literature class. I mean, you're certainly not going to be reading Carl Hiaasen in high school, so.
Eudora Welty writes some funny stories.
Yes. And then I know some that are more like on the, like, paranormal fiction, gothic fiction, like modern gothic fiction's scale, but certainly like it's a heavily genre fiction is where you start to get like, I don't know, it's a little less, I don't want to say judgmental, but just kind of more accepting, like this is what it is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit at first about the book. This book, as I mentioned, written in 1899. Kate Chopin was a well-respected author up to this point. She'd written she'd written a few stories and I think another novel. I'm not sure, but this was the novel that kind of put her on the map and then whisked her off it almost immediately because
promptly ended her career.
It was seen as completely inappropriate for a woman or anyone to write this novel. So poor Kate Chopin had to, she actually ended her life not in obscurity exactly, but certainly on a down note, and it wasn't till many years afterwards that this novel was reassessed as a kind of a proto-feminist novel. Although, you know, reading it through, I have my doubts about that. I don't know. I'm curious to know what you think about that when we talk about theme. Is there any background that you want to bring up?
Well, yeah. I mean, I just want to point out that Kate Chopin was a pretty fearless person in her life. I mean, she was raised by women. She grew up reading women. She didn't live in this man's world, so. When she started writing this book, she was like, oh, isn't this weird how, like, women just do what their husbands want them to do or their fathers? Isn't that strange? And, I mean, I feel like that really colored her life and it colored this novel. So, I mean, in a way, I would definitely agree on the proto-feminist aspect when you look at how her life colored this writing.
Okay, let's do the plot here. This is, it's not a long novel. It has... If you looked at a summary, it has like 39 chapters, but all the chapters are tiny little chapters. There's like there's one that's like a paragraph long, even I remember in the middle. And this is the story of Edna Pontellier, who's the youngish wife of New Orleans businessman Léonce Pontellier. She's, I believe, 29 is her, given at one point in the book. And she's a mother to sons Etienne and Raoul. And at the beginning of the book, she's vacationing on Grand Isle at Madame Lebrun's resort.
Yes.
Here, she swims by day and dines by night with her friend Adèle Ratignolle, who is the model of turn-of-the-century domesticity. And with Robert Lebrun, who is the charming son of Madame Lebrun, she finds herself attracted to this Creole young man, and she also finds herself attracted to the music of the local bohemian Madame Riez. Is that how it's pronounced?
Rice, actually.
Rice, yeah. Madame Rice, sorry, who awakens a desire in Edna for self-expression, and this mostly comes out in her refusing to go to bed when her husband says to. Fearing that he's getting too close, Robert Lebrun announces that he's going to Mexico for some never-explained reason, and at the end of the summer, Edna finds herself back in New Orleans. Her husband is away on business, and she feels ever more trapped by her life of domesticity. There's a local physician named Dr. Mandalay, who is more understanding of her situation than you might think he would be, and he tells Léonce to give Edna room to herself, which she takes by moving into a cottage alone, taking up painting, and also taking up a sexual relationship with a local Lothario named Alce Araban. But at the end, all the off-page sex leaves her unfulfilled, and when Robert shows up at the end of the book just to say that they can't actually be together, Edna decides she's had enough. She returns to Grand Isle for one last swim, and this time she goes too far out.
Yes.
And that's how the book ends.
Real downer.
Now, it's not a plot-heavy novel, but it is a novel that has a lot of charm in the writing, in the specificity of place. Characters are given rich voices, and a lot is made of the difference between sort of standard Southern culture and Creole culture. And although I have to admit that as an outsider to both, I have a hard time sort of distinguishing what exactly marks one or the other. This is not a book where they give ridiculous accents to people. So you're from the South. You tell me all about this.
Well, I mean, not being Creole myself, I couldn't go into great detail about that, but I believe there's a certain looseness with the way, you know, it's mentioned early in the book that it's natural for, you know, the husbands never get jealous. There's always flirts, and, you know, it's just kind of this thing they're very open about what goes on behind doors. They're very, you know, affectionate and quite a bit less stuck up than Edna's, you know, Presbyterian Kentucky upbringing. So And that's an adjustment for her at first. And that's kind of the first inkling we see of this, you know, awakening in her, is these getting comfortable with spending time with Adele and Adele's sort of comfort around Robert and his flirtation. And
yeah, let's talk a little bit about this awakening, because this is the central trope of the book, or the central metaphor of the book, is waking up. And there are maybe six or seven places throughout the book where people actually talk at length about waking up, either literally or figuratively. Mm-hmm. There's one remarkable segment that gets quoted a lot in the middle of Edna's and Robert's early relationship, where she tells Robert she had been asleep and she woke up and it's as if she'd slept for 100 years and all of humanity had disappeared and transformed into new creatures. It's kind of a surreal point of the book. You know, this is not a book that is, this is a very literal book, but that was a kind of a lovely poetic segment, although it also is the kind of florid language that I associate more with the 19th century.
How many years have I slept? She inquired. The whole island seems changed. A new race of beings must have sprung up, leaving only you and me as past relics. How many ages ago did Madame Antoine and Tony die? And when did our people from Grand Isle disappear from the earth? He familiarly adjusted a ruffle upon her shoulder. You have slept precisely 100 years. I was left here to guard your slumbers, and for 100 years I have been out under the shed reading a book. The only evil I couldn't prevent was to keep a broiled fowl from drying up.
It was just kind of an interesting part of the book because, I mean, there's so much. Because I believe that was about the part where she is just starting to realize this is the day after she hears Mademoiselle Rice play for her. And so, like, she's already experienced kind of this, like, flush of awakening with, like, to art. And she starts thinking about herself in terms of her art and her painting and seeing the world as art. So I feel like that kind of lends to that. And also on the little boat trip over to the church, she, you know, became jealous for the first time of the little Mexican girl that was flirting with Robert. So, I mean, there's like all kinds of layers of things going on in this one short stretch of pages.
When I was reading this through, I read it through once, and then we had planned on getting together to record this, and we had to put it off, and then we were planning on doing it again, and we put it off again. And this episode has been in the works now for, I think, like, years at this point. And I reread it just this last week to try and get it back into my head. And I was struck again by how mushy my sense of place is with this book. I was having a hard time remembering which segments took place on Grand Isle, which segments took place in New Orleans. And part of that is the culture that's described is so different from anything that I know. Edna's life does seem to be this constant party, not like party, but like everyone's gonna come over and they're gonna be talking around.
She never has time to herself, like ever.
Yeah, she's constantly either at some sort of a salon, or she's off at the beach with people, and there's no clear division between her family and the LeBruns. And with the people on the island, everyone's just like coming and going. You mentioned at the beginning Jane Austen. I find that to be something that happens whenever I read Jane Austen too, because I realize that when you're talking about the aristocracy of the early 19th century, people just kind of wandered around England going from house to house and kind of living there now I live here for 3 weeks.
Right. And yeah, that is what they did.
And I felt they get the same kind of feeling from reading this book. Like, I don't know what anyone does.
Because, you know, the husband is leaving and coming back on the weekends, and, you know, it's kind of, they're kind of all over the place. And I mean, it was actually funny because when I was young, when I was a kid, we actually vacationed on the Gulf of Mexico, not in this part, on that part, but on the Florida side. And that's kind of how it was, though. I mean, we had a whole big house, and the whole family would come, and people would come and go. And this week someone was here, and this week someone else was here. So I don't know if that's a Southern thing or if that's just, you know, the culture of the time, but.
Yeah. So there is. There's that. I think the other thing is this central metaphor of awakening is it comes with another metaphor, which is the metaphor of being asleep, or at least sleepwalking, and Edna's slow realization that she feels that she's sleepwalking through life and that she doesn't have any real agency over anything she does, or nothing that she does seems to have meaning for her. And since this book is written so much inside Edna's head, there's a kind of a soporific way there's a wonderful free audiobook version of this. If you just like search on iTunes for audiobook of The Awakening, there's an audiobook that was recorded. Oh geez, I should really look up the name of the person who did that.
I also listened to the audiobook to refresh my memory, but it was the one read by Kim Basinger, and that was
oh well, that would
who reads very slowly.
Yeah, the thing about it is if you listen to, you might think that an audiobook would be an easier way to get your way through this book, but I found it actually more difficult.
Yeah,
because for one thing, you can read the book a lot faster than anyone can read it aloud to you. And the other thing is I kept falling asleep whenever I would listen to this. And not because I don't like the book, but because that's the kind of language that's going on in this book.
It's very soft throughout, like just even like describing, you know, her inner turmoil. It's this very soft language, and it's very, I don't know, there's something gentle about, you know, even that. And you listening to it, you do find yourself kind of like nodding off.
Right. Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about Edna's dilemma here. Yeah. Because Edna,
poor Edna,
I remember in my class, and this was a graduate class already, a lot of people were a little less sympathetic to Edna than I thought they might be.
Because she was a mother?
Because, well, again, yeah, exactly. Because she, you know how it is when you are a young reader and people are very quick to want to find what the problem is in a book. Mm-hmm. They want to identify a problem in the book and say, oh, the issue is this character did not deal with this problem correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And Edna does all the things she's not supposed to do. She realizes she's not in love with her husband. By all accounts, her husband has nothing particularly wrong with him, other than the fact that he's kind of boring.
And he sees his wife as just another one of his possessions.
Right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when Edna disobeys him or puts her foot down about something, he seems to say, okay, fine. I'll let you do that.
Unless she wants to sleep in a hammock.
Right.
And then he's really annoying. I just got so angry reading that.
When she moves out of the house,
yeah,
there's a funny exchange by letter where you would think he would be very upset because...
his wife is leaving him.
His wife is leaving. Exactly. I think any sensitive guy would realize... there is something really wrong with this marriage.
That doesn't even enter into his head. Like, he doesn't even see it as her leaving him. He's just like, oh, but people will think we're poor.
Right. That's what he's upset about is the way he'll be viewed.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he lets her do it. You know, he doesn't
rush back. Yeah.
He doesn't assert the control that he might.
Mm.
Now. And by all accounts, she has a comfortable life, but she doesn't like him, and she also thinks the kids are okay, but as the book goes on, you realize she's just not very interested in
mothering. Yeah, I mean, some people just aren't built for it, and that's okay. And kind of at the time, it's just like, what choice did she have? Which is why Mademoiselle Rice is such an interesting character, because, I mean, you have Adele, who, like you said, is kind of the paragon of what a woman should, at the time, should have been, and then you have Mademoiselle Rice on the other side, and Edna's kind of somewhere in the middle, just like, you know, which way do I go? And, you know, I thought it was good to have that character in there as kind of a, you know, Edna kind of definitely starts leaning more towards her side, the bohemian sort of rebellious life, that even in the end she rejects that.
Right. Now that's I like what you bring up there, because I remember in my class, people tended to dwell upon the issue of infidelity.
Hmm.
And that's actually, it's not unexpected. That's what contemporary readers of this novel dwelt upon, and that's one of the reasons they were very upset with this book. Mm. Was they thought that it was just grossly sexual, although oh my god, is it about as so chaste not. As you could possibly be. I mean, the sexiest thing is that the one chapter ends with Alcée did not leave until Edna had become supple to his entreaties. You've got to read a lot into that.
Yeah.
But romance is a kind of a dead end for Edna. Mm. I mean, certainly Alce, with whom she actually has a sexual relationship, she doesn't really care about him as a person in any way.
I don't know that she particularly likes him.
Right. But she sees him as useful.
Amusing, kind of, I think.
Right. She's in the market for some physical gratification, and he supplies that. And there is something quite subversive about that, because he's the one who has the reputation of being this lady killer.
Mm.
And she seems just, as willing to use him for anything. But Robert is a dead end as well. And not simply because he has scruples and doesn't want to break up Edna's marriage. I think that she, by the end of the book, she doesn't find that satisfying. She doesn't find the pursuit of romance satisfying.
Mm.
And the thing that I found quite startling about this book was, first of all, how little the book was about romance, and how much of it was about the pursuit of an authentic self through the arts.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, it seems as though Edna found that unsatisfying as well.
Yeah, and I feel like she didn't want to be any one thing, I think, and she felt trapped by the limitations of the time. I mean, she couldn't get... She basically did, like, the most shocking thing a woman could do at the time, and, you know, she stopped taking visitors and started, like, doing art and moved out of the house and, you know, shuffled her kids off with her mother-in-law. So it's like, all of these things that she was seeking this experience and wanting to find her individual self, and no one took her seriously. Like, people would still come by and, oh, Edna, you're so funny, and, you know, come to her parties and talk about how wonderful her parties were, and it's just like nothing changed. Her husband didn't recognize this. I mean, he didn't even bother coming home from New York to say, hey, what's up with you? What's going on with, you know, this situation. So it's just like nothing she did, you know, was making, she could not make her mark. She could not be heard. She could not be seen, is kind of how I always took it. It's kind of that last realization, like, nothing I do matters because everyone already sees me as this one particular thing, and that's never going to change.
I think that the narrative voice of this book makes the case that Edna's entrapment is entirely based upon societal expectations of motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
But as a reader, I started to kind of question whether or not Edna really would have been happy in another time either, because she seems to have this inchoate longing for more. And certainly, at this time, women weren't supposed to have their own desires, either sexually, mm-hmm. or economically, or
artistically.
Yeah, certainly artistically. And if they had any desires that went against the cult of domesticity, that was seen as pathological.
Mm-hmm.
But Edna takes up painting for, I don't know, a month or two.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a hard proposition. my background, my undergraduate degree is in studio art. Painting is hard. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, and obviously people spend their lives trying to get better at that. So there's a part of me that wonders whether Edna would have been even happy if she had a society that was willing to support her desire to go off by herself. But maybe she would have. I mean, the other thing that painting takes is it takes the resources of a community of people, of teachers and peers mm-hmm. who will support you in that, and the leisure that it takes, that the time, that's a certain luxury to be able to do art.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be able to have the resources to be able to do that. And Edna didn't have any of those.
No, she didn't. So the one person in the book that might have been a resource to her and understanding of her, she just completely blows off with the doctor.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of one of the more interesting characters in the book because, you know, he seems to have had some experience with sort of the crush that women feel in this life sometimes, and what was making overtures to her as, you know, you can talk to me. And I kind of always wonder, like, how different this book would have ended if she had just talked to the damn doctor.
Yeah, well, he was being kind of oblique
yeah.
in the way that people were oblique at this
yeah.
time. He is an interesting character because he strikes me as being way more enlightened than anyone else around
mm-hmm.
him. And he gets very quickly to the heart of what's going on in Edna's head. I just wish he... Part of the problem with Dr. Mandalay is he is so woke that he doesn't want to be patronizing to anyone. He doesn't want to say, this is what Edna has to do,
yeah.
or he doesn't want to involve himself anymore with Edna's husband
mm-hmm.
than that. I agree. Edna talks to the doctor in the penultimate chapter
yeah,
of the book.
Yeah, she's walking, he's walking her home or something, yeah.
Right, and it's a very poignant chapter when you know what's going to happen to
mm-hmm.
Edna, because he really is kind of laying it on the line, saying, you know, if you're hurting, if you feel like you're going to do anything, you know, maybe I can help. And, you know, that kind of language is surprising coming at this time, certainly from a doctor, because this is the time when women are still believed to suffer from
hysteria,
hysteria and stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, and I kind of wondered if that maybe that wasn't why he sort of understood more than the men around him. So I thought one of the more interesting parts featuring the doctor was when her father comes to visit and they're all kind of having this big party and her husband is there and her father is there and the doctor is there and he's watching how she interacts with these men in her life and he's just like, this is messed up. You know, you kind of get a little glimpse into his head and he's not best pleased with the men in Edna's life. The two more interesting characters in the book for me, besides the doctor, in terms of how they interacted with Edna would be Mademoiselle Rice, who is, you know, she's like this little reclusive woman and very unpleasant and, you know, just like someone that I don't think I would voluntarily want to spend time with, but Edna feels very drawn to her and drawn to her. I guess she sees it as kind of bravery in the beginning, and I found it interesting how Robert sort of also sees that and reaches out to her to talk about Edna. I find Robert to be a very cowardly character. He won't talk to... Everyone kind of sees what's happening, and he runs away. He won't talk to his mother about Edna, but he'll write about her to Mademoiselle Rice, pages and pages. And, you know, he comes back only to be like, yeah, I love you, but, what are you gonna do? And, you know, I just feel like, in the end, I think that Robert ended up being, like, more disappointment than he was worth. It's just another trifling man now. I don't know. I love kind of everything about the parts in the beginning when they're on the Grand Isle, and she's coming into this awareness, because there's a lot of like funny little characters that are sort of peppered throughout that kind of, I feel they sort of allude to what is going to happen. Like you have these, the lovers that are always followed by this little old lady in black. And that's kind of like, you know, these are kind of Edna's two choices in life, always following her around.
Right. There's also a parrot who speaks yes. French, who is actually the first character in the book. And the beginning of the book has definitely a lightness of touch and a very commanding, I think that Chopin has this commanding ability to depict the place and the kind of society that's going on here. I found that immensely charming. It reminded me in a weird way of the opening of War and Peace. If you read War and Peace through those, that book starts with a soiree. And in fact, the book continues through several thousand pages. Every like 20 chapters or so, we go back to yet another soiree at the same place. And it's a way of checking in on all the characters and seeing what they're up to. So it's a good device for bringing people together. But I'll have to admit, the ending of the book, while I think it's well written, it's beautifully, the actual act of suicide is written in with a lot of sensitivity and restraint. I have a problem with it, which is the same problem I have with a lot of 19th century literature, which is 19th century literature, whenever a character sort of crossed a societal line, there was either suicide or some other kind of ignoble death that awaited the main character. And I feel like it was sort of an expectation of writing, because it's sort of like, what do you do now? The character isn't going to be accepted back into society. I can't imagine writing the character striking off on their own. So here's what happens. And it bothers me. This is the thing that bothers me about Anna Karenina, for example.
I think that's a much better example than this one, though. I just kind of feel like in some of these novels, this one, Anna Karenina, like they're doing, it's the only thing that they can control. And I feel like in some aspects, like this is the only thing that they can do that's just theirs.
I brought up The Yellow Wallpaper, which is a great story that I probably should do for sophomore lit sometime.
It gave me the creeps for many years.
a very creepy story about a woman feeling trapped in a life of domesticity and being trapped by motherhood. And that doesn't end with death, but it does end with insanity or something approaching insanity. And there, another story that this reminded me of in a funny way is Edith Wharton's book Summer. I don't know if you've ever read Summer.
I've read some Edith Wharton, but not that one.
Yeah, it's Edith Wharton is known for her very dark black endings. You know, everyone knows Ethan Frome ends with one of the most disturbing endings of all time.
I'll never go on a sled ever.
But Summer is a story about a woman who like Edna, has a sexual awakening in the course of the novel, who doesn't fit into the society. In this case, it's New York, but upstate New York. It's not it's not New York City, and she gets pregnant by a man she's not married to. And she ends up marrying another man. And I think it's a beautiful book because it is such a, it's got such a lovely ending in a way. It's like neither, it's neither a complete tragedy nor is it a complete success for the character. It's about a character moving on and making peace with her life in a way, mm-hmm. and finding a way to maybe society isn't giving her what she wants, but here's a way that she's claimed a little bit of herself outside of that.
Yeah.
I thought that it was, I think it's a really good book to read. If like me, you are tired of of poor women who just can't catch a break in these turn-of-the-century novels.
Far From the Madding Crowd might also be a good one.
But you know what I mean? I feel like it's very like the problem that happened with gay and lesbian characters in the 60s and 70s, where they always had to end up committing suicide in a story because that was the only thing that the author could think to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, I just, you know, I like Edna. I wish something better had happened for her.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that would have been.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, like you said, it's hard to imagine the story continuing on in any other way. Robert was not good enough. Her life was stifling. Her art, whatever. I mean, who was going to buy the art of a fallen woman?
Right. Now, I do think you mentioned very early on this mm-hmm. this central thing issue of motherhood, and mm-hmm. that the real, as you mentioned, that readers rebel. Readers don't like Edna because even more than leaving her husband, she leaves her kids.
That's always a thing with any literature, any kind of culture you consume, like any entertainment you consume. If it's a bad mom, I'm using air quotes here. If it's a bad mom, like it really turns people off.
Yeah, this is. I think that your point is a good point, and it's one to think a lot about. I know that better minds than mine have written a lot on this subject, but it does really. It's funny because certainly there's the trope in popular culture of the absent father.
Mm.
You know, the father who was a rambling man who left he just up and left the family,
mm-hmm.
and usually if that's this character, the plot finds some way to reintroduce the family, the father late in the game to the adult children, and there's some sort of a reckoning or some sort of either they come to an understanding or they don't,
mm-hmm.
but that's seen as a kind of a natural situation, and while it's not great that daddy left, it's part of it. It's seen as somehow sympathetic.
It's more forgivable,
right. Whereas it's never forgivable for women.
Mm-mm.
And
yeah, I was just thinking actually about The Hours, and the character, you know, the mother leaves and is just. I mean, her choices in that story are suicide or I leave. And she chose to leave, and you know there were consequences of that. And I feel like the story was a little more sympathetic to that character than you see portrayed in a lot of these, stories where women are just not fit to be mothers. They're just not. They want more from life. And I don't know. I have a real problem with the expectation that you know you shouldn't want more from life, and that you should just live for your children. Like, I don't think your children would really want that.
Yeah. And today, at least, well, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's easy today, not so much right. when this book was written.
Unfortunately, there still is a heavy expectation that women will at one point in their life want to have children and be mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And there are at least alternative narratives out there, even though society, I think, as a whole, still puts a lot of pressure on women.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about the 19th century, when you don't have any economic avenues open to you other than marriage, you're kind of stuck, you know. There's no birth control in 1899 that's going to, I mean, there is birth control, but it's not going to work to keep you from being a mom for the next 60 years of your life.
Right. I don't know. It's that's one of the things that made this book a much tougher read for me now, you know, at 40 than it did at 15. I don't have children, and I've just, you know, made the decision I'm not going to have kids, but, you know, it's still like, you're still reading this, you just feel like, as a woman, like, I felt this kind of grinding pressure all the time reading it. This is terrible. No wonder the poor woman went swimming.
So talk about reading this again. Mm-hmm. Now, I will always feel as I read this book like I'm a tourist in this book. You know, this is not about my experience. I'm very happy to read about it and to try to understand it as much as I can. Mm-hmm. But I recognize greatly where my personal experience ends, and I have to just kind of listen. So tell me about your feelings of then and now. You mentioned you felt differently about this than you did as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, at 15, what do you really know about, you know, these pressures of adult life and marriage and expectations and things? And granted, like, I don't have nearly the kind of pressure and expectation on me now that, you know, I would have had I lived in the time when this book was written. But at the same time, it still exists. It's still there. It's still, you know, now that I've lived my life a little more, like, reading through this, I found myself relating to a lot of it. Her wanting to stop doing, you know, stop seeing people and do art. I'm just like, well, that's kind of what I do now. I sort of just stay at home and write and don't talk to people, and that's how it goes. But, you know, it's a lot more accepted for me than it would have been for her. This expectation of always, you know, being the ideal. And that's something I feel like women a lot of times put on themselves, because it is expected of us, and just something that I wasn't aware of until I was older and had lived a while. But I found Edna to be, in a lot of ways, much more sympathetic this time reading it through than I did when I was 15. I still liked the book and I liked the story when I was 15, but I mean, now at 40, I feel like I relate to her a lot more and kind of feel a lot more tenderness and sympathy towards her. The woman just wanted to take a nap in a hammock.
Reading it through now, there's a part of me that really is curious about. I would have loved to have been able to visit this resort in 1899.
Mm-hmm. It's still there.
I was recently, well, not recently, about a year and a half ago, I was in New Orleans, and there is something enormously appealing about New Orleans in that it is it's right smack in the most the deepest part of the South, in the most southern, most conservative part of the South. You have this crazy place that is not like anywhere else in the United States. It is French, and it is strange, and it is full of odd characters and odd customs, and it is just an amazing place. And I kind of you could imagine writing another story where Edna, maybe Mademoiselle Rice, was able to take Edna somewhere off to her little cottage somewhere on the north side of the French Quarter, and was able to introduce her to, I don't know, you know,
all the characters,
you know. You just would like her to have an out, you know.
And
And it feels like a book in which there was
she does spend a lot of time winning money at the racetrack.
Yeah.
I guess it doesn't quite count, but kind of I found that to be pretty amusing.
Yeah.
No, New Orleans is amazing. I'm glad this book is so strange to me because I've read a lot of books set in New Orleans, and this book feels the least New Orleans of all the ones that I've read.
Right. Well, this is about the high society of New Orleans.
I would have no context.
Right. It's not about Creoles in the 17th century. It's not about freed African Americans living alongside slaves in the 19th century. It's not about the French quarters or jazz or voodoo or anything like that. Nope. It's about a very genteel part of rarefied society that was still highly influenced by French culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all gone, you know. So that's the other thing that makes me curious about it. I think I would probably find it. I would like it for about a day to visit, and then I would find it extremely suffocating, I'm sure.
Yeah. That actually is kind of a feeling I had throughout the whole book, is sort of this feeling of suffocation, because it's hot there, and then you have all this incredible, like, emotional weight behind everything that's happening, and it's just like I'm feeling, and she's wearing all these like high collar dresses, and like, everything is confining. And it's just like those few like moments of freedom when she gets to like unbutton her in the beginning, you know, she describes like unbuttoning her collar and letting the air touch her skin. And it's just like, oh.
Well, when she commits suicide, she puts on her bathing suit, and then she completely goes naked into the ocean. It's a very potent image.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a reverse birth of Venus.
Yeah.
The only thing that worries me about the book is it does have a kind of a romantic view of suicide. I guess that's okay. I mean, art has to be able to be free to investigate those dark impulses that we have. But
it's a very prettily written suicide,
right?
Yeah,
but I would not want someone who is suggestible to read this book, because it is
no, certainly not. It is. It took me a while to get through it the first time I reread it. I reread it when we were planning to do it before, and then listened to the audiobook more recently. But rereading it again this time, it's just like, it's been a tough year. This is hard to read. But yeah, it does sort of make everything seem very inviting and freedom at last.
Right. Well, we all need to have a dark and depressing book that we can hold close.
Yes.
I'm glad it was recovered.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. A lot of the great American novels are recovered novels.
They were too scandalous for their time.
Huckleberry Finn was not well received in its time. It only got elevated many years afterwards. Moby Dick certainly was a huge flop until it was revitalized in the 20th century. I'm glad that Chopin got saved. I don't know that I'll ever read this book again, though. I think it's
out of curiosity, I always look to see if there was a movie version, and there was a movie version of book made. It was made in the late 80s, early 90s, I think, and it had to have been the 80s, because it stars Kelly McGillis as Edna. And
Kelly McGillis?
Yes. Huh. And Julian Sands is Alce, and oh gosh, a baby-faced Adrian Pastar as Robert. But you cannot find it anywhere unless you have a VHS player, and then you can buy it for $50 on Amazon. But I'm always curious. I watched a few previews, and Ellen Burstyn, I think, plays Mademoiselle Rice.
So that makes sense.
I feel like this this book maybe deserves another adaptation. It maybe deserves a little modern lens on it. So I would be I would be interested to watch that, but I don't know that I'll read this. In fact, Sammy was here last night and I thrust my copy at her and I said, take it.
It seems to me like the sort of thing that Jane Campion would do an adaptation of.
Yeah. Yeah. She'd be perfect, actually.
Thanks to co-host Beth Arin. Look for her books under the pen name Beau North. The reading this time was by Remy Maisel. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join in the discussion on The Incomparable membership Slack, or search for and join the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. Hope your midterms are going well, and keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.